I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our PennSound archive, writing.upenn.edu/PennSound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by John Tim Payne, poet, teacher, and for the last bunch of years, the commentary page editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer, frequent contributor to the Inky's Sunday Ideas section, and dear friend of the Writer's House, one of our earliest local supporters and author of Yes, It's True, Poetry for Dummies. Is this still in print?
Oh, it's definitely still
absolutely.
In print.
Absolutely. Get out and buy it. And by Jamie Lee Jocelyn, writer of nonfiction, engaged in writing a book-length account of the death of her mother, longtime coordinator of the Kelly Writer's House Fellows Program, alumna of the Bennington College MFA program, who is currently teaching a creative writing workshop here at Penn, and once again, TAing a course on representations of the Holocaust. And by Peter Balakian, poet and nonfiction writer, author of numerous poetry collections, including most recently Ziggurat, Chicago Press 2010, and June Tree, New and Selected Poems 1974 to 2000, who has also written the memoir Black Dog of Fate and The Burning Tigris, The Armenian Genocide and America's Response, and is co-translator of the book Bloody News from My Friend by the Armenian poet, help me pronounce the name, Siamanto. John, good to see you. Thanks for crossing the river here and coming to the west, the left bank, I should say.
I was just going to say, it's great to change banks.
And Jamie Lee, thanks for
I crossed the third floor of the
really,
writer's house.
From one room on the third floor to the
it
other.
It was really hard.
It was hard. And Peter, welcome to the writer's house, I believe for the first time.
Good to be here, Al.
And
good to be
back to Poem
Talk
for the first time. So thanks for... And you're traveling via New York from my alma mater, Colgate University.
That's right. An epic journey, but
epic
good
journey
to be
from
here.
Hamilton. Thank you. So today we're convened to talk about a poem in Gregory Janikian's 2007 book, So I Will Till the Ground, a series of poems about the experience of his family before, during, and mostly after the Armenian Genocide. Our poem is called Armenian Pastoral, 1915, and it appears about halfway through the first of the book's three sections. Our recording was made in 2007 here at the Writer's House during a reading marking the occasion of the book's publication. So here now is Gregory Janikian reading Armenian Pastoral.
Armenian Pastoral, 1915. The names that I'll... you'll hear names, and they're Armenian names of both men and women. Armenian Pastoral, 1915. Memory is useless if none of us remembers the same things. Bruce Murphy said that. If Anoush were holding her child and watching the sheep carted off like men to the slaughter, and Armenag in his dark vest and trousers were hobbling barefoot in the village square toward the pockmarked wall, and Ashod in his prison cell were counting the sprigs of parsley that must be rising in his garden now, if Araxi were razor thin by the roadside dreaming of a white mountain turning red in the alpenglow, if Antranig, refusing to walk, were shod like a horse and tethered in his own pasture, and Azniv were a wet nurse now to a battalion of mouths, her infant slit clean in the straw, how long would it have to go on then, beginning with A and spilling over into all the alphabets, before mother, sister, father, child, could wear the same faces in any language, be cut from the same tongue.
So the structure of this thing is a series of if clauses, conditionals. What effect, John Tim Payne, does that have on the way the poem works for you as a reader?
Well, it means that 90% of it is one big, huge, increasingly heavy dependent clause that explodes with a question at the end. If all these things are true, how long would it take? Mm-hmm. And the odd care with which the poet make sure that you hear the were, which is the less and less used subjunctive of is, along with the finely observed detail makes you think that the were's are is's, that if this happened, the question would be, well, it did happen, and so the question is. So it actually gets reversed just by those details.
Interesting. Peter, your thought on the structure of this thing?
You know, for me, it does several things. Linguistically, it sets up what I think this poem is in part shaped by, a kind of anaphoric and chant-like structure, which is rhythmically effective and moves well as we move through those very tightly made three-line stanzas. And then for me, this conditional also positions the poet in a relationship to history that is, you know, bound up in questioning and imagining the unimaginable. So it suggests an interesting way of engaging the hard to grasp past, especially a past that's defined by mass violence, mass murder, genocide, cultural eradication.
So, Jamie Lee, let's gather a couple topics here. So here's the big one, the relationship between names and genocide. Why do names seem particularly important here, either specifically in this poem or more generally when one considers how to represent a genocide?
Well, actually, I was just thinking about that in terms of the visceral way we react to the poem, like we were saying with this conditional. The names accumulate throughout the poem, kind of like this tension, this kind of crescendo of tension we were just speaking of with the if clauses accumulate. You know, so there's this tension accumulating, there's more names, and then in terms of genocide, you know, there's this sort of incomprehensible spilling over almost of all these names that just accumulate as we think about this, that we can't really even wrap our minds around, this sort of infinite number of people. And so all we can do kind of is say their names as much as we can.
So, John, why do the names have such an impact in this particular poem? What's the strategy here by using the names?
Well, one of the things it made me think about was much as was just being said. In a way, they give a local habitation and a name to all the things that are going on in the poem. But it's also true that these people, although they have names, which usually specify a person for us, they remain anonymous because they are named anonymous entities, which is a bit of a contradiction in terms. But it's still true. This is a person to whom this happened who happened to have this name. But we can't get any closer than that. So it's like any list of atrocities. It's sort of a commentary on how much cannot be said.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, the names are kind of, they're very specific, but like you were saying, John, there's almost an arbitrary nature of
yes.
it, which I'm sure we'll get to when we talk about the fact that they're all A names. They're all names
yeah,
that begin
so
with A.
Peter, let's go there with the, well, why the A names?
Yeah, let me
Why
just,
didn't he do A to Z in the poem itself?
Let me play off of the first question, and I'll circle back to this part of the A. I mean, I think one of the things that Greg has smuggled into the poem in a very important way is Armenian language. So for the average, you know, reader, the reader who doesn't know this language, all of a sudden we have the music of these names, which are very, solid and popular Armenian names. And we have a lot of A names. We have a lot of K names. There's certain letters in Armenian that appear.
So A is actually a fortunate choice, not just the first letter of the alphabet.
I think so, although mm-hmm. that's, you know, I mean, Greg is also obviously playing with the first letter of the alphabet
sure.
to
right.
set up what he wants to set up about, you know, human identity, etc. Mm-hmm. But yes, these A names have a certain intensity about them to my Armenian ear and culture. So my sense of culture. So I think Greg has smuggled a piece of the culture into the poem in an essential way that allows us to hear these sounds. And they're quite, you know, musical name, Araxi, Antranig, Asnif. They're musical names. So we, since genocide, of course, as Raphael Lemkin reminds us again and again, involves not just the killing of people, but the destruction of culture, we have both culture and language and the sound of language, as well as names and identities. Gets both in.
And we seem to have landscape as well, or at least it's implied in the use of the word pastoral in the title.
Absolutely.
Or is that just completely ironic? Jamie Lee?
Well, I think it is ironic in part, but I don't think it's completely ironic, because he actually is kind of slowly walking us through these scenes, which in some ways are quite simple, just in terms of how they're set up. And, you know, you have the village square, you have, you know, if you just kind of let your eyes glance on certain words in this, the Alpenglow, what a beautiful word that is, you know. And I say that with a little kind of sarcasm in my voice. But then, of course, like you were suggesting, there's this juxtaposition from the very start, given what we're talking about.
What kind of atrocities do we have here? These are all A, and they're not alphabetical. I thought they would be alphabetical. When I saw the AZ, I thought, oh, this thing, it's not alphabetical, but they are the A's. And you would think that by the time we got to Z, if he could ever get there, things would be really bad. And yet the atrocities in each stanza are not a crescendo. We have, actually, and I'm a student of genocide, and I have to say that what Antranig goes through is, to me, completely freshly horrifying.
Mm-hmm. Very creatively so.
Creative on the part of the perpetrators of this genocide, right. And perhaps also on the part of Greg, who's done his research. Refusing to walk, were shod like a horse and tethered in his own path. That is really, really horrifying. But we have two middle stanzas where Ashad is in prison thinking of the sprigs of parsley coming up in his garden.
Well, I think the word pastoral, you know, is ironic, I agree, of course. But it does situate the mass killing and atrocities in this history, in this genocide case, in this agrarian world where most of the killing took place. I mean, not all, but this is an event that's defined by a dramatic pre-modern rural terrain. And the Turkish government and the Turkish gendarmerie used the terrain skillfully in order to kill people, much like the Nazis used terrain to carry out mass murder.
Such as forests.
Yeah, especially, I've been to Auschwitz-Birkenau. I mean, you don't pick that casually. That's a
yes.
place you definitely want to set up a killing factory. Similarly, happened in the dramatic terrain. I keep using the word dramatic, and I would suggest that if you want to get a good image of it, the best I can come up with is think of the American Southwest Southern Rockies. You're dealing with these kinds of spaces, mountainous regions, canyons, cliffs. I mean, a little different, but that's an approximation. So I think that Greg is calling that forward so well in the title and then in the chips of
pastoral is an
rural.
Is an undercurrent in our thinking about genocide. Killing fields, just the phrase. And then, of course, Claude Lanzmann in doing Shoah really makes a film that is quite pastoral, long, sweeping views of fields, and leaves it to us to understand what's below that tall grass. John, you were going to say something before, when I was talking about the quality of the atrocities or the sprig of parsley.
One of the things I was thinking about while I was seeing the names and realizing that they were not in what we call alphabetical order, I I read one line in this many, many times and realized why only belatedly. In the second to last stanza, how long would it have to go on then, beginning with A and spilling over into all the alphabets? And what my brain wanted it to say is all the letters of the alphabet, but that's not what it says. It says all the alphabets. It seems to call attention, and I don't exactly know how to explain why I think so.
Let's talk about that triplet, that stanza, though. Come on, how does the... You're the word guy. Well, we're all word guys, but you always do this when you come to Poem Talk. What's the quality of the language of that? It's not. It's very un-Janikian. Like un-Janikian-esque. It's a lot of prepositions. It's
yes.
Hard to read, hard to get your
head around.
The
first line especially, you have to
how
slow down.
How long would it have to go on then, beginning with and spilling over into?
Right. Mm-hmm.
But you're also so ready for it by that point, because you get all these ifs, and so you're waiting for that. You know, I might have even cheated a little the first time I read it and said, where's the if going to turn? I need to know if what, yeah. You know, and I feel like I haven't breathed until then.
Oh, I agree. I think it's very consciously unlyric. Unlyric, I'm sorry for that word, but I mean, it's very consciously contorted. Yes?
Oh, yeah, I think so. And I mean, all the alphabets are all arbitrary. They are ready-made ways of ordering things,
right.
But that doesn't make them any less arbitrary for all that. They're ways we choose to order the unorderable, and so it only seems like a list. It's just sort of a stack, a pile.
And to say the very least, Peter, when we discuss verse witnessing, prose witnessing to genocide, language is challenged. To say the most obvious thing that one could talk about for hours, but I invite you to say how that, insofar as that is expressed in this poem, how?
Well, something happens at this moment in the poem that there's a shift of gears. And for me, the poem shifts out of the particularity of history into a suggestion of a broader human reality. And it gives the poem this very important new layer. I think it really, you know, it makes the poem something even more special in doing that. And it's a great, I think, tribute to Greg's sense to go there, you know, rather than come back into the particularity of the Armenian-ness, but to go into...
It's a risky thing to do because it has the chance of falling flat.
It's an old-fashioned moral.
Yeah, so it starts with the epigraph and ends with the last stanza. Can anyone commit the sin of paraphrase and just tell us what the last stanza is saying? Who wants to take a stab at that? John's looking down. Jamie Lee.
I guess I didn't look down in time. I would say, I mean, so before mother, sister, father, child, he's talking about these kind of universal roles that we all...
Categories, yeah.
Yeah, categories, things that we all feel or have in our lives in one way or another, whether they're present or absent, could wear the same faces in any language. So it's almost... You know, to go back to the previous stanza, it's like, how long before we all concern ourselves with this? It's almost a plea or a call to action. Mm-hmm. And I would then, you know, my eyes then go right back up to that epigraph, which suggests, you know, we must remember. Memory is useless if none of us remembers the same things. It calls to community. It calls to the people in our lives. It calls to the
need to do that. And it requires a language that can be understood. Yes. Or a language about an ex,
or at least
that
does
is
not
a common
divide.
Enough experience,
yeah.
That can be comprehended. I'm going to quiz you, Peter. You probably know the answer to this. Where is the epigraph from? You do know this,
I
right?
I do know it's from a review of my...
A review of
my,
your
new and
selected
poems in Poetry Magazine.
Isn't that great?
What a coincidence.
Yeah, funny. We should invite you for this.
Fortuitous.
I mean, it's not as if there aren't a lot of Armenian poets running around the United States that have 2002 review by Bruce Murphy of your book, in which Bruce Murphy wrote, and obviously Janikian was paying attention. Although Balakian, that's you, may be tired of his imprisonment in history, everyone is, he still tries to reach across. Blakean is one of the few who realized that memory, realized is a past tense word, oddly, unless I mistyped that, who realized that memory is useless if none of us remembers the same things. Let's go back to that first statement, though. Although Blakean may be tired of his imprisonment in history, are you tired of your imprisonment in history? And is Janikian in this poem?
I need a psychiatric couch and about 5 hours now to answer that.
I know. And this is only a 30-minute show.
Very briefly, I don't want to talk
this
about
this is not an occasion for modesty,
myself,
though.
But okay. I think the reviewer picked up on a line in a poem of mine in the new section of that book, that New and Selected, in which I talk about my coming to the Yorkshire Dales to get out of history. You know, it's a piece of a poem. And so, you know, a piece of a poem charts a moment in your sensibility, but it's not something you can really generalize or extrapolate from. Certain poets are more located in history than other kinds of poets. And I'm a poet for whom history has been important. I know that Greg is a poet for whom history is a informing energy.
If Antranig, refusing to walk, were shod like a horse and tethered in his own pasture, and Asniv were a wet nurse now to a battalion of mouths, her infant slit clean in the straw, how long would it have to go on then, beginning with A and spilling over into all the alphabets, before mother, sister, father, child could wear the same faces in any language, be cut from the same tongue?
So the final line of the poem somehow cuts two ways. Cut is...
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's a face, the same faces cut from the same tongue. So if you leave cut out, you have people speaking the dreamt of common language and understanding each other. But cut from the same tongue conjures up the opposite, doesn't it? It conjures up a face that has no ability to speak. What do we do with that, Peter?
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful tribute to Greg's work, the way he's ended this poem, the way he's come to its opening. The closing of the poem is an opening to something else. And I think that the trope of language is what allows him to negotiate this push toward the universal, toward the broadly human, all into all the alphabets, mother, sister, father, child, faces, any language, and then that kind of complicated paradox of cut from the same tongue, which suggests both the possibility of a universal humanity, but also the wound of slaughter and killing when the tongue is silenced. And it also, you know, it's a way of also suggesting the great power of language, both as human speech and culture, and as you've noted, Al, as a form of witness trope. So really, for me, a wonderful closing.
So we could talk about this and the related issues for a long time, but why don't we go around and each add one more thing that we wanted to say about this poem but didn't have a chance to so far in the discussion. Jamie Lee Jocelyn, a final thought on this?
Yeah. Oddly, my final thought lingers on that epigraph. It really challenges me, this idea that, you know, what it suggests is that we have to make sure we all remember, or that more than one person remembers whatever the thing is, the capital S something. And, you know, often when you talk about survivor testimony or the chain of witness, you inevitably have to have some kind of ethics come up about, is it good to tell these stories? Is it good to force people to relive this in language and in words. And right here, it suggests absolutely it's an absolute necessity. And otherwise, we have nothing. And I think, you know, this will definitely be sticking with me. And it makes me think about the kind of writing that we all have to do, that I have to do, maybe about my family, not about a culture necessarily, or not even about a genocide. But, you know, I really do think of this as a call to action.
Interesting point, because it produces possibly a counterintuitive result, where you think about what you've learned in writing workshops or from common therapeutic assumptions around the U.S. that when you go deep, you should be very specific and you should imagine a particular person. What Greg derives from the idea, Bruce Murphy's idea, which was a response to Peter Blakian, is to decide to go typological, to be more general.
Right.
As a way of accomplishing more, which has the risk of being abstract, but chances that the success will be something that's not simply about his family, right, but about a common experience. And Terence Dupre, in his book The Survivor, daringly talked about, a long time ago, talked about how he wanted to see the voices of survivors as a kind of common voice, which was a daring thing, and he got really slammed for it because we're always into the specific voice.
And at first it sounds almost insulting or almost, you know, reductive.
A denial of individuality.
Right, yeah.
Exactly.
Right. Which
but
goes
Terence
back to our...
kept hearing, as he was reading all these accounts, some of the same things over and over, and he decided to use a kind of general tone, what he called almost a quasi-religious, although it had nothing to do with religious belief, a tone, quasi-archaic tone, to talk in general, at a time when it seemed like we should be reading the precise names of the dead. He began to somewhat erase the individual names of the witnesses so that we had a sense of the collective. And I think to some degree that's what Greg has kind of the same realization he's come to. Well, I did my final word, but I went out of turn. So, John Timpane, your final thought on this?
Well, you were making a typological point a moment ago, so I'd like to make a typographical point.
Okay.
The word cut also means printed. And we see an explosion of italic typefaces at the end. And this is just as finely wrought as anything else in the poem. And it brings us back to the notion of being cut from the same tongue, almost trying to imagine a moment when we are printed out of the same language, because language is a way of being born, and a way of being born to a way of seeing things, so that we can be cut from the same tongue, and we can be in the same typeface, because after we're all gone, all we will be is writing.
Well said, John. Peter, final thought.
Well, just to perhaps reflect on your notion here about the particular and the universal, I think what's for me is essential in some way in a good piece of work is the tension between the two. I mean, you do want your locale and your rooting and your cultural specificity, and then you are happy to see a poem like this engage that broader reality. So it's the tension, and it's powerful. And the title Pastoral of this poem, Armenian Pastoral, and its play off the title of Greg's book, So I Shall Till the Ground, you know, does evoke the the notion of survivor affirmation, and the kind of intersection of the uprooting from land and the reclamation of those rhythms, and the rhythms of poetry as being able to embody such rhythms is a powerful claim for language, and the particular form of the poem with its rhythmic nature.
Thank you, Peter. We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. And Jamie Lee has a smug look because she knows what she wants to affirm. So please.
That's right. I wanted to mention a friend of mine, friend of the Writer's House, friend of Poem Talk, Michelle Taransky. Mm. She has a chapbook out now by Brave Men Press. It's been out for a little while. It's called No, I Will Be in the Woods. And you can just go to Brave Men Press's website. And it's actually this gorgeous letterpress cover. And I'm going to be getting a few copies just to give out as gifts. And I'm really excited about it.
Terrific. Thank you, Jamie Lee. Peter Balakian, Gather Some Paradise.
Two books come to mind. One by my good friend Bruce Smith, new book out, Devotions. It's a University of Chicago Press book, and these are really rich, layered, edgy poems that deal with the whole kind of morass of American culture, and terrific poems. I want to put that book next to a book written in 1720 by Defoe. Not that the two books really are paired in any way, but they're both in my head right now, and that is A Journal of the Plague Year. Mm. Really an edgy piece of poetics in which I think, and I'm immersed in the book at this moment, in which I think the notions of what we came to call new journalism are born, and
absolutely.
A blurring of genre boundaries is kind of consummated in a very, it's a very modern book. So I hope readers will find Devotions and Journal of the Plague Year.
Never been prouder of my alma mater that Balakian would come from there to give the first 18th century book recommendation during our Gathering Paradise segment. Thank you. So that's all the plague years we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, John Tim Payne, Jamie Lee Jocelyn, and Peter Balakian, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, Christopher Martin, and to our editor, as always, Steve McLaughlin. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us soon for another Poem Talk.